With the temperature dipping below freezing, many local governments try to help the homeless find temporary shelter. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. This week, these so-called Code Blue programs have been cropping up all across South Jersey. WHYY's Joe Hernandez starts us off.
In Bridgeton, the Code Blue program is run completely by volunteers. Mayor Albert Kelly and faith-based leaders turn churches across the city into temporary warming centers for the homeless.
We open up one of the various churches. We have volunteers come to man the church, but also we have people who come to serve various meals to the clients. So we have a dinner, and in the morning we have a light breakfast available for them.
Bridgeton stepped up its Code Blue efforts after the 2013 death of a homeless man who was trying to find shelter from the cold. Kelly says the all-volunteer initiative helps unite the Cumberland County city.
It really has brought our city together. When you have a common enemy, it seems to bring people together. And the enemy is the cold weather and the lack of shelter. And so it's brought out the best in our city.
Salem County is developing a Code Blue program too, but like Bridgeton's, it'll be run completely outside of local government. In Camden County, Volunteers of America sends outreach teams out to help the homeless find resources. Program director Tanisha Marshall says it isn't always easy to convince a person to take help.
We usually go out and see if the individual want to come in. Usually on the first try, they don't. But if they're constantly going and checking on them, we can sway them into at least going to apply for services or coming in to get a shelter bed or shower and cleaned up and, you know, warm clothing.
Cape May and Burlington counties have also issued Code Blues this week and have hotlines set up with information about shelters. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Hundreds of children and their families are facing homelessness in Delaware, and the numbers got worse during 2015. WHYY Zoe Reed has more from the Delaware desk.
23-year-old Sasha of Wilmington, her 4-year-old son Lemire, 2-year-old daughter Serenity, and 1-year-old son Sincere have been homeless for 1 year. The four of them have moved through several shelters in Wilmington, and we're omitting their last names for privacy. Sasha, who's expecting a fourth child, says what hurts the most is when her oldest child asks questions about their situation.
When my son be like, Mom, I want to go home. And I really can't tell him, oh, well, we don't have a home. And all I think I say is, okay, Mommy's trying.
They are only one of hundreds of homeless families in Delaware who live in shelters, churches, motels, and even cars. The Homeless Planning Council of Delaware served 664 children by the end of November, up 25 from 2014, even before the year was over. The council's executive director, Phyllis Chamberlain, says most of the kids were 5 or younger.
It seems that generally people think that it's people that are single men on the street, but there's really so many families that end up very sadly in a homeless situation.
She says homelessness can lead to depression and health issues, which is why it's crucial to get a family into a stable home. Chamberlain says in their rapid rehousing strategy, they place a family in a unit and pay the first few months' rent. Then the family pays half the rent and eventually all of it.
It really goes by the philosophy that housing provides a family and children with the stability that they need in order to live a good life.
For 2016, Sasha's case manager has found her housing. She gets to move in this month. She's currently working a part-time cleaning job and hopes to find another so she'll be able to afford it on her own. From the Delaware desk, I'm Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
As reported on this station today, an emotional President Obama signed a series of executive orders today aimed at curbing gun violence in America. The order expands background checks and closes the so-called gun show loophole. Joining me now is Shira Goodman. She's executive director of Ceasefire PA, and she was at the White House during today's signing. Shira, what was the mood in the room when the president signed these orders?
The speech got a lot of applause. But it was also very emotional. The president was introduced by Mark Barden, who lost his son at Sandy Hook. And so I think it was very emotional, and I think there was a lot of excitement that something was happening, that the president was using his authority to move the ball forward.
This is a federal mandate, but of course state laws can be more stringent than the federal government. What effect would these laws have in Pennsylvania?
So in Pennsylvania right now, Anytime you go to a federally licensed dealer, just like anywhere in the nation, you have to get a background check for whatever you buy. And also under Pennsylvania law, any private sale of a handgun requires a background check. The loophole that we have isn't so much a gun show loophole as it is a private sale loophole for the sale of long guns, rifles, shotguns, the semi-automatic rifles that are often used in mass shootings. You can buy those long guns in a private sale without a background check, and that's whether it's, you know, in a parking lot or at a yard sale or at a gun show by a private seller. So that loophole still exists. What the president's order does is refine the definition of who is engaged in the business of dealing guns. So for the high-volume private sellers, people who are really selling a lot of guns, they are now going to be forced to become licensed dealers and fall under the regulation of the ATF and perform background checks. But for the occasional seller, the person who's really selling a gun here or there from their personal collection, that's still going to be allowed to proceed without a background check. So we don't know exactly how much of the private sale of long guns in Pennsylvania this order will affect.
Well, the last decade or so has been marked by mass shootings that the president has referred to frequently during his calls for legislation on gun control. Do you think, given that that long gun loophole still exists, these measures can have an impact at reducing the incidence of mass shootings?
I think that any time you make it harder for people who are intent on doing harm to get those weapons, you can make things safer. We just should not have avenues where people who want to avoid background checks can avoid background checks, because the law-abiding people who should be able to exercise their right to bear arms or to hunt or to engage in the shooting sports, they're going to pass their background check and they're going to be able to buy what they want and do it quickly. And with the improvements announced today in terms of funding and staffing, the background check system should be even more efficient and even more effective.
When we had you on the show last year, Ceasefire PA was pressing back against a law that made it possible for independent groups like the NRA to bring lawsuits against municipalities without having standing, so they could challenge local gun laws even though they weren't directly impacted by them. And that law was struck down in June. What's the state of local gun laws right now in Pennsylvania? Can they be challenged still after this law was struck down?
Well, a lot of municipalities, once that law was enacted and anticipation of it going to effect, getting threatening letters from some of the gun lobby lawyers, started to rescind their local ordinances, started to change their ordinances into resolutions calling on Harrisburg to act. So at the moment, that law is not in effect. And the lawsuits that were pending, most of them are being held in abeyance until that lawsuit is finally settled. Surprisingly, the state defendants, the Speaker of the House, the Senate Majority Leader, appealed the unanimous decision of the Commonwealth Court, and that Act 192 challenge is going up to the Supreme Court. So I think that there are municipalities that would like to be able to do more. They want to be able to act legally, but they also want to be able to take steps that they think will keep their community safer. And Harrisburg has hamstrung them. We're just glad that that law was struck down, and we're confident that the Supreme Court will affirm what the Commonwealth Court did.
Shira Goodman is Executive Director of Ceasefire PA. She's speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Shira, thanks so much.
Thank you.
As its annual flower show approaches, the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society has chosen a new president. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports Matt Rader has deep experience in urban development.
The Pennsylvania Horticultural Society did a national search to replace former president Drew Becker, who left last summer. It found Matt Rader, who has lived in Philadelphia for most of the last 15 years.
I'm from a town called Mercersburg, which is a very small town of about 1,500 people out in south central Pennsylvania, far outnumbered by dairy cows.
Despite growing up in a farming town, Rader has little hands-on experience with horticulture. His professional life has been focused mostly on community building in a South Philly business district and nationally with the Urban Land Institute in Washington, D.C. Board Chair Margaret Sadler says she wasn't looking for a gardener.
If you want to know about trees and plants or weeds, bugs, and dirt, we've got 100 people at PHS. So that's not really what we needed. What we needed was someone who had a good, strong sense of what an organization needs going forward, as well as somebody who understood the not-for-profit world, which she does.
Much of what the Horticultural Society does focuses on sustainable urban development, such as community gardens and the summer pop-up gardens, which temporarily take over vacant land to create a showcase garden and serve beer. Rader says they serve as community outreach vehicles.
I've been at the nexus of community members, the city, philanthropic community, and change.
Rader takes over next week, and his first goal is to meet as many people as possible who are involved with the society. He will get that opportunity at the annual flower show in March, where he can shake the hands of 3,400 volunteers. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
In today's headlines, Philadelphia has a new commissioner at the helm of the country's fourth largest police department. Richard Ross was sworn in by Mayor Jim Kenney today in a ceremony at Central High School, his alma mater. Ross, a 26-year veteran of the force, says he's focused on improving police and community relations and using technology like body cameras to help fight crime. He replaces Charles Ramsey, a well-regarded leader who presided over a dramatic decline in homicides. A Chester County company that publishes business newsletters will pay about $1.75 million to thousands of employees who are forced to clock out while going on short breaks, including for the bathroom. The Philadelphia Inquirer reports the Department of Labor filed a lawsuit in 2012 claiming Malvern-based American Future Systems violated the Federal Labor Standards Act because employees were not earning minimum wage when the company required them to clock out for breaks. We will have a low of about 14 degrees tonight. Tomorrow, sunny and not so harsh, with a high of about 40 degrees. You're listening to NewsWorks tonight on WHYY. Still ahead, before same-sex marriage was legal, adoption was a way for partners to be recognized as family for legal and medical purposes.
This is something we've known about for years, this practice.
Now, those adoptions are becoming a bureaucratic headache for same-sex couples looking to marry. That's coming up as NewsWorks Tonight continues.
So this is interesting. Foreign tourists aren't vacationing here as much as they used to, but when they do, they're doing it on the cheap.
We certainly haven't spent as much this time around as we did the last time we were in New York. We bought jeans and aftershave and perfume, and this time around we've bought very little.
I'm Kai Rizal. Tourism and the strong dollar, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6:30 on WHYY.
Support for WHYY is provided by the Southwest Council, Inc., founded in 1991 as a primary alcohol, tobacco, and other drug prevention services provider. The Southwest Council is home to three active and effective substance abuse prevention coalitions in Cumberland, Gloucester, and Salem County, New Jersey. Each coalition is comprised of active community members and professionals of all ages and from all walks of life. More information on Southwest Council's coalitions is available at swccoalitions.org or 800-856-9609.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov, in for Dave Heller. We usually think about adoption as a relationship solely between parents and children. It's not. Before same-sex marriage became legal across the United States, some couples would become parent and child just on paper to get the rights they were otherwise denied. WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports that one Pennsylvania couple has ended up at the center of a legal battle over these adoptions.
Drew Bozé and Nino Esposito met at a party in Pittsburgh on Easter weekend of 1970.
And Nino was there, and we were introduced, and that was about it for that weekend.
Bozé was living in Montgomery County at the time, but he found himself charmed by the Steel City and moved there in August of that year. A few months later,
I went one evening to a bar, a gay bar. Lo and behold, there was Nino again.
Esposito, the quieter of the two and 10 years older than Bozé, nods in agreement. He says that night was the last time they each went out looking for love.
Once we met each other, we stopped going. I mean, that was the whole thing. Why go? What was the reason? There was no reason.
The next year, Bozé moved in with Esposito and his parents. They lived quietly together as a couple, buying homes and acting as each other's plus ones. But for most of their life, there was no way for them to legally become a family. About 20 years ago, a lawyer mentioned that adoption could be one way for them to more fully share assets and benefits, like health insurance. But it wasn't until 2012 that they went to a judge and Esposito formally adopted Bose.
He told Nino, you know, you will now be responsible for Drew. And he said, well, I've been responsible for him for 41 or 2 years. So, and he made sure I was in agreement. He said, I see no reason why I shouldn't grant you the adoptions.
Long before same-sex marriage was legal, adoption was a way to make sure partners would be recognized as family in the event one member became sick or passed away. Without legal protection, members of same-sex couples have been forcibly removed from their partners' hospital rooms and have been denied powers of attorney and other legal benefits. Nancy Polakoff is a law professor at American University and an expert in LGBT family law.
This is something we've known about for years, this practice, but there's never been a way to track numbers, and there still isn't a way to track numbers.
She says the practice wasn't rare, and she's heard of cases around the country. These adoptions, while a good option at the time, don't offer nearly as many benefits as same-sex marriage, which became legal everywhere after a Supreme Court ruling earlier this year. That decision actually created a dilemma for couples like Bose and Esposito. In 25 states, including Pennsylvania, a parent can face jail time for marrying their adoptive child. Still, Bose and Esposito knew of a few other couples, two in Bucks County and one in Harrisburg, who had annulled similar adoptions with no trouble. In June, they asked a judge to end their adoption. Esposito says right off the bat, they knew something was wrong.
When we walked into that courtroom, we knew what he was going to say. His whole demeanor and his attitude, we knew exactly he was going to deny it.
Judge Lawrence O'Toole denied their request, saying, quote, the Adoption Act does not have a provision permitting the annulment or revocation of the adoption. His decision also implied that the men's only reason for wanting to get married was to avoid paying inheritance tax. Polakoff, the law expert, says this is the only case she's seen of this kind of annulment being blocked. The Pennsylvania ACLU has filed an amicus brief in support of Bose and Esposito's right to annul. Esposito says he feels discriminated against and impatient.
He better hurry up because this week I turned 79 years old. I don't have all the time in the world.
Bose says they'll keep up the fight as long as they can afford to. The couple filed an appeal in July and are waiting for the Superior Court to set a date for arguments in early 2016. In the meantime, the $80 in cash they pulled out to use for a marriage license that day in June is tucked away in a folder, gathering dust until the day they can finally use it. I'm Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
As the occupation of a federal building in eastern Oregon plays out, commentator Solomon Jones says the perpetrators aren't so different in their actions from those in other parts of the world, and we shouldn't hesitate to call them by the same name.
If terrorism is the use of violence and intimidation for political aims, then the armed men who've occupied a building in a wildlife reserve in Oregon are by definition terrorists. Led by Ammon Bundy, the 40-year-old son of anti-government Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy, the armed men took over the building after accusing federal officials of unfairly punishing Dwight and Stephen Hammond, ranchers who were convicted of arson and sentenced to prison after setting a fire that burned 130 acres. But Bundy and his followers do not represent the Hammonds. They represent themselves. And in my view, any peace-loving American who believes in the rule of law should repudiate Bundy's tactics, because if Islamic extremists who brandish guns in pursuit of political gain are labeled terrorists, then right-wing extremists who do the same must fall under the same definition. If we allow men like Bundy to adopt the language of patriotism to rationalize utter thuggery, we are allowing terrorism to win the day simply because it changed its clothes and dressed itself as a rancher. Bundy and his followers claim they occupied the building because of federal overreach that's left ranchers in fear, restricted, and impoverished. Once they can use these lands as free men, Bundy said, then we will have accomplished what we've come to accomplish, and there will be no need for us to be here. I struggle to understand what any of that has to do with the fact that the Hammonds committed arson, illegally burning 130 acres in what the government said was an attempt by the Hammonds to cover up their poaching. I also struggle to understand why Bundy is positioning himself as a representative of the people of Harney County when he openly admits it might take a little bit for people to realize that. More than anything, I'm confused by the fact that Bundy claims the people of Harney County, Oregon, are not free men. Bundy, his followers, and the people of Harney County are free in ways that most people in this world are not. They're free to demand a redress of grievances from their government and to bear arms in a country where guns are available to every law-abiding citizen. They are free, quite frankly, to make claims that may or may not be true and to do so in pursuit of political gain. But when they take up arms, illegally occupy a government building, and threaten violence if they're confronted by law enforcement, they're engaging in terrorism. Until we're ready to admit that, the Bundys of the world will continue to hold America hostage. We should never allow them to do so unchecked. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog on Newsworks.org. Finally, through the power of social media and concerned strangers, a Philadelphia woman has been reunited with her missing engagement ring. While shopping on New Year's Day in the Cherry Hill Mall, the woman lost the 33-year-old keepsake. Her son stepped in and posted a picture of the ring on Facebook. The post was shared more than 11,000 times. As luck would have it, a man living just 6 blocks away found the ring. Seeing the Facebook post, he returned it to the woman's son, who then creatively gave the ring to his mother by getting down on one knee and asking, "Would you be my mother?" The son awarded the man $1,000 for reuniting his mother with the precious heirloom. No word on whether she said yes. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by myself and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Chris Christie's popularity may be up in New Hampshire, but it's plummeting in his own state. Tomorrow evening, how Christie's time out of state is affecting his image at home. Thanks for joining us. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov for Newsworks Tonight.
Support comes from Widener University Delaware Law School. A Juris Doctor degree from Delaware Law is designed to help you to start your legal career with confidence. Located in Wilmington, Delaware Law offers flexible scheduling with full and part-time classes, allowing you to earn your Juris Doctor degree on your time. Delaware Law is hosting an information session on Saturday, January 9th at 10 a.m. More information at delawarelaw.widener.edu. That's delawarelaw.widener.edu. Widener Leadership Works.
Next time on The World, new voters in Houston.
My dad was deported in 2006, and my mother was about to be deported when I was in the sixth grade.
Young Latinos have their issue. Now they need to get organized and registered.
We have to go out and vote. We have to make it happen.
A move in Texas to politicize young Latinos. That's on The World.
Tonight at 8 on WHYY.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing education at PAFA invites you to join their community of artists of all ages and levels of experience this spring. Featuring classes in drawing, painting, sculpture, and printmaking, with PAFA's noted faculty, pre-college Saturday classes for high school students, and weekend master classes with Stuart Shills, Dan Miller, and Nasa Grassi. Registration is now open and classes begin January 25th. For details, pafa.edu/ce.